How's your sleep been here the last week or the last month or the last year? I kind of go up and down on it a little bit because we're in the process of closing on one house and trying to sell another house and all the finances and stuff. My sleep has been interrupted a few times in the middle of the night when I've awaken, and then you sit there thinking, about things, and you might be awake for a half hour, even an hour sometimes. And that makes me tired. We're going to talk about the importance of sleep today with Dr. Ruth Benka, who's a professor of psychiatry and psychology at the UW-Madison. And she directs the University Center for Sleep Medicine and Sleep Research. Our other guest today, Dr. David Plant, is an assistant professor of psychiatry and the newest, a sleep physician at the Center for Sleep Medicine and Sleep Research. So great to have both of them with us today to talk about sleep and the importance of it and maybe how you and I can get a better night's sleep. We'll find out and talk about can be some serious issues relating to our sleep or the lack thereof. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Dr. Ruth Benka, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having us.
And Dr. David Plant, thank you so much as well. Great
thank
to have
it's
you.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Great to have you with us tonight. Dr. Benka, you're going to actually be speaking tonight, are you not?
That's correct.
At Perry Hall at the UW-Fox Valley?
Yes, that's right.
What are you going to be talking about?
I'm going to be talking about sleep and aging.
Oh. The sleep, do people who, as they age, do we sleep better or worse?
Well, unfortunately, we generally do not sleep better. On the other hand, It's not the case that you have to necessarily have poor quality or problematic sleep as you get older.
Not necessarily the
case. Not necessarily the case. You should be right.
Well, Dr. Plant, you're new to the clinic.
I am.
What brought you to it?
Well, just a wonderful clinic. I think Wisconsin Sleep is, I looked all over the country, actually, at different sleep centers, and it was the one that was the most exciting to me. So,
how did you happen to get involved in it?
In sleep medicine in general?
Yeah, sleep medicine.
Well, so I'm probably from a generation where sleep medicine really was sort of a fully designed subspecialty. So it was something that I had some exposure to when I was in medical school, and sleep was a fascinating topic, so I just kind of pursued it all the way through. So,
what is the function of sleep? That's a very basic question, but I'm going to ask that. What's the function of sleep, and why is it so important to get a good night's sleep?
Well, that's the most important question, and it's the one that we're least able to answer right now. It's actually quite interesting because of all the behaviors that humans and other creatures engage in, sleep is still the most mysterious. However, we do know that sleep is critically important for brain function, and it's primarily important for all the things that the brain needs to do, including learning and memory and adapting to the environment and emotional regulation. And we certainly are very familiar with a lot of the effects of having inadequate sleep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Comment?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, like Dr. Benka was saying, really the function of sleep is one of the fundamental questions that science still has to answer. We know why we need oxygen, we know why we need water, and we know why we need food, but we have no idea exactly, why we need sleep. But certainly, probably the best way to answer what the function of sleep would be to say there's probably many different functions. It's sort of like asking, well, what's the function of waking to a certain degree? So it has effects both on the brain, but also secondarily on a whole host of other organ systems. Like we know that, for example, sleep deprivation can hurt the immune system. It can have effects on the endocrine system and metabolic problems. So people who are chronically sleep deprived tend to have poor glucose tolerance, which is similar to what you might see in diabetes. So really, sleep is important for a whole host of things, but we like to think that it's the brain is the most important, and then all other systems sort of are secondary to the brain.
And do we know how much sleep that we a sort of average person, and probably there is no average person, but I don't know what the average would be, but how much sleep normally would you consider to be a good night's sleep, Dr. Benka?
Well, I mean, the epidemiologic studies suggest that about 7 hours a night seems to be associated with the lowest risks of mortality in adults. Obviously, younger people need to sleep more. Adolescents and children need a lot more sleep than adults. Mm-hmm. But there's, of course, a bell-shaped curve, and there are people who can get by with less sleep, and some people, unfortunately, who would need more sleep than that. The problem, though, is that as a society, we're all somewhat chronically sleep deprived, and people in general don't get as much sleep as they should.
We have callers, lots of callers online to visit with you. So let's take some calls here. And Patty from Wausau will put you on first. Hi, Patty. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. Can you please tell me how diet and caloric intake might impact sleep patterns at night, especially for teens?
Oh, okay.
So particular to teenagers, that's a difficult question. Patty, are you asking about the amount of calories or the types of food that might affect sleep? Or
Both. I have heard stories of where people who maybe don't get enough calories during the day tend to wake up more frequently during the night. Mm-hmm. Or, certain types of food might cause restless sleep at night.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's some truth to what you've heard. Certainly, if you go to sleep hungry, it can be harder for you to sleep through the night. And sometimes people who have difficulty sleeping, we might actually recommend having a small snack before they go to sleep just to sort of prevent that problem. And certainly there are foods that I think from person to person would vary, but could disrupt sleep, especially if people have nighttime reflux and things like that. Spicy foods and things like that might cause problems. But there isn't a lot of research into foods specifically that would disrupt sleep, except for those that perhaps contain caffeine. So avoiding too much chocolate in the evening and things like that, which can actually have a fair amount of caffeine, is important.
I expect alcohol would as well.
Yes, but hopefully teenagers aren't drinking too much alcohol.
Well, yeah, for teenagers, yeah. let's hope anyway. Patty, does that help?
Yeah, I think so. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
I would just
add to that.
Yeah, I just want to add one other thing, though, while we're on the topic of eating and sleep, particularly in younger people. And there's increasing evidence that people who don't sleep enough actually overeat and are more likely to gain weight or be obese. And some of these effects are more pronounced in children and adolescents. So sort of the other way around, not so much how does what you eat affect your sleep, but how does your sleep affect what you eat? So sleep and teenagers are often sleep deprived. So a sleep deprived teenager might be more likely to binge eat and sort of pig out on junk food than someone who might be sleeping a more normal or adequate amount.
All right. There you go. Let's go to Tom and Stoddard. Tom, hello to you.
Good morning. I wanted to share with you my experience. And I had had leg cramps really bad. I've had Lyme disease recently in the last 4 years. And my cramps were really bothering me and increasing in frequency and severity. And I had heard on the People's Pharmacy on Wisconsin Public Radio about alpha-lipoic acid being good for nerve damage. So I started taking it, and it really helped. And another thing that it helped with was I was having this experience where I'd be sleeping, and all of a sudden my mouth would slam shut. My mouth was hanging open, and I would bite my lip or my tongue really painfully, and then I'd be really alert.
You know, you're breaking up here a bit on us, and it's getting hard to understand. Any comments? I'm sorry, Tom, but the line sort of went bad here a bit for you. Dr. Plant, any comment?
Well, I think the first comment would be to talk about some of the leg sensations that he was experiencing at night. It sounds like they were quite frustrating for you. I would say, actually, the alpha-lipoic acid is something that I'm not familiar with using, but if you've had success with it, that's good to hear. When we in sleep medicine hear about nighttime leg cramps, we want to think if the person might have something called restless leg syndrome, which is a sensory motor disorder that's characterized by a few cardinal symptoms that can be an urge to move the legs where it's difficult sitting still. And basically, they come on when you're sitting still. And typically, that sensation gets a little bit better when you move, but then tends to come back after you stop moving. And it always occurs. It's usually worse at night. Almost usually exclusively occurs at night, but sometimes during the day as well. I'm not sure if the caller was experiencing what we'd consider to be classical restless legs. There's a lot of other things that you have to think about, like just nocturnal leg cramps, which people can have. Sometimes people call them Charlie horses as well. So that's what I would take from that caller's.
Yeah, and then there are some, there are other conditions, including his Lyme disease, and also sometimes medication effects that can cause muscle pain that people may be more aware of when they're lying in bed quietly and not distracted by other activities.
Yeah. On to Darwin in DeSoto. Your turn. Hi, Darwin.
How you doing today?
Good.
Excellent. I'm 63 years old. Back in 1976, I had a motorcycle accident that gave me a half a lobotomy on the left side of my skull, 5 open skull fractures. And ever since then, I have never been able to sleep unless I have been medicated. I presently am on 60 milligrams of temazepam per evening, and I get between 4 and 5 hours of sleep, and that's it.
Wow. Comments, Dr. Menka?
Well, certainly head injuries can have pretty widespread effects on brain function, and sleep disturbance after a significant head injury is not unusual.
Okay.
The other concern, though, is that if this has been going on for a long time, it's not necessarily the case that what is interfering with sleep now is the same thing that was going on 35 years ago, particularly because as we get older, a lot of other disorders can kind of creep in and start affecting our sleep. That's a pretty high dose of temazepam, and I would want to make sure that there wasn't any sleep-related breathing problem, like sleep apnea, some of those sleep breathing problems tend to get worse as we get older. If we put on weight, certainly with head injuries, they can be present. So I'd want to make sure that the caller has, had some screening by his physician regarding the possibility of sleep apnea or other common sleep disorders that could be contributing at this point.
Okay. Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Ruth Menka, professor of psychiatry and psychology at the UW-Madison, director of the Center for Sleep Medicine and Sleep Research. One of our guests, the other, Dr. David Plant, assistant professor of psychiatry and also on the center staff for sleep medicine and sleep research. They'll be with us till 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. Talking about the importance of sleep today with Dr. Ruth Menka, professor of psychiatry and psychology at the UW-Madison, director of the University Center for Sleep Medicine and Sleep Research, Dr. David Plant, our other guest, assistant professor of psychiatry, also at the Center for Sleep Medicine and Sleep Research. And I'm sure they're both heavily involved in Wisconsin Sleep, which is the clinic arm of their research unit. And I certainly want to bring that up, because if you were going to seek services, you'd probably be going through Wisconsin Sleep if you were going to be doing that. They have a website, wisconsinsleep.org. And a good place to go to take a look at what they have for services and to make appointments and so forth. We have Debbie in Eau Claire up with a comment for you, or question. Debbie, hi. Thank you very much for calling.
Good morning. I'm 56, in good health, and never had a problem sleeping until I reached the magical age of menopause.
Yeah.
And have been on Ambien for a couple of years. At first was only taking it occasionally when I had to work the next morning, and then the other evenings I was getting okay success using like Tylenol PM or other over-the-counter things. As time has gone by, I have had less and less success with the over-the-counters. And right now, I am only taking the Ambien and using that every night. Getting, 6 to 6.5 hours of sleep, doing fairly well, but I would sure love to be able to just go to bed at night and fall asleep like I used to. Yeah. Any ideas for something I might be able to throw at my doctor?
All right.
That's a great question, and your experience is unfortunately fairly common. Women often experience increasing problems with sleep when they start running into menopause, usually perimenopausally, and sometimes that gets better later on. Sometimes the sleep disruption is actually related to some of the hormonal fluctuations and to vasomotor symptoms or hot flashes at night. And one key thing I always tell women who are noticing more sleep disturbance is to make sure your bedroom is cool, because we become a lot more susceptible to being even the slightest bit overheated at night. One of the normal processes during sleep is basically our thermostat in our brain drops. In other words, our body, we try to lower our body temperature at night, which is a lot of times why you wake up sweating during the night. And particularly for women of a certain age, that can contribute to awakenings at night. So, you know, having layers and clothing that sort of wicks moisture away from you and being able to shed layers of covers or bedclothes during the night sometimes helps. I sort of an interesting anecdote is that for a lot of women, when they hit menopause, it's the first time when the struggles over the bedroom temperature switch. I know sort of went through this with my own husband, which was, you know, for years I was always complaining the bedroom was too cold. Now he complains it's too cold. So make sure your bedroom is cool. You know, making sure that there are no other sleep disorders that might be interfering. Again, as women get a bit older, and particularly when they go through menopause, they're more likely to start having a sleep apnea or sleep-related movement problems that can fragment their sleep. And in women, sleep apnea doesn't always present the same way as in men. So, you know, check to see if you're snoring at night. That might be a sign. And even with the sleep disruption, make sure you're getting enough exercise during the day. I like to advise menopausal women in general to exercise vigorously, or as vigorously as you can, because obviously we're, you know, worrying about keeping our bone loss to a minimum as well. And exercise helps sleep too. And on the other hand, if everything else is fine and a sleeping medication is working and not causing problems, you know, increasingly we recognize that sometimes people need a little bit of extra, you know, medication more chronically. There are also behavioral treatments, however, that can help sleep, and that's another avenue to investigate.
Mm-hmm. All right. There you go. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Is this some of the research that is going on at your center?
Well, actually, yes. We're starting to look at what happens to sleep with aging in a little bit more detail. We have some new technology at our center. We can actually put on 256 electrodes onto the scalp with a with a cap, and we can basically take a picture of the entire brain at night. And the brain sort of sleeps differently in different parts across the night, if you will, in sort of a oversimplification. And one of the things that's interesting is exactly what is happening with sleep as we get older. And what we're starting to see is that as we sort of lose neurons as we get older, and the connections between the neurons, the synapses sort of get lost as well. You know, sleep becomes less deep as a result. And that sort of, you know, raises the issue as to whether activities that sort of increase the connections between neurons, like increased mental and physical activity during the day, may also help to improve sleep at night, like they seem to help to improve other functions.
Let's turn to Angie and Eau Claire next. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. My husband
has night terrors almost every evening. He dreams every night, and the terrors will wake him up periodically also. Is there any sense of what may cause that? And is there something, sort of a test or something that we could do with him to see maybe what is causing it, or to try to reduce the amount that he dreams and wakes up?
David,
they're not good dreams.
Dr. Plant?
Well, so I think that gets to a really important point about what a night terror is. And I think it would make sense for your husband to see a sleep specialist. The term night terrors can mean different things. Sometimes it can be vivid nightmares, which are just, you know, dreams that have scary content that cause people to wake up. Also, night terrors can be a type of parasomnia that you see in children, but also sometimes in adults, where they arouse from sleep and aren't aware of their surroundings and can scream and be inconsolable. And there's sort of different things. Sometimes also these unusual behaviors during sleep can be caused by other sleep disorders that may be comorbid or causing arousals from sleep, like obstructive sleep apnea, where the airway might close off during sleep and cause people to arouse and then scream. Or if that happens during a particular type of sleep, like REM sleep, which is deeper dreaming sleep, it can cause similar types of symptoms. So what I'd say to the caller is that certainly it would probably be worth seeing a physician about that to get a better handle on what might be going on at night.
So what would a physician do if a physician's, all right, the husband goes in and is, all right, I'm waking up with these, you know, I have bad dreams and I wake up almost shouting or whatever.
Sure. Well, usually what we do is we try to get as thorough of a history as possible, when the symptoms started, what the symptoms are specifically. For sleep medicine, it's very important to try to get a sense of what goes on over the course of a 24-hour day as well, including what time the symptoms might start at night, because that is indicative more of one type of parasomnia than another, for example, in this particular case. And we also get, you know, a thorough medical and psychiatric history, and try to see if there's anything else that might be triggering these particular events. And then oftentimes what will happen is people will be referred for a sleep study, and there's a number of different types, but they all sort of involve staying in the lab generally overnight where you're observed, and we look for certain markers that can be seen in certain disorders.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to Carissa in Baldwin next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a pediatric occupational therapist. I work outside of the Twin Cities. And so I work with a lot of kids with different neurological anomalies, but especially kids with autism or ADHD. And a lot of those kids that I work with have a lot of sleep issues or difficulty sleeping or insomnia. So I'm curious if there's any research going on right now with the guests into autism or children and sleep deprivation.
Well, I think there's a number of issues here that you raise, and certainly kids, first of all, with autism or developmental disorders, we'll start with those and then talk a little bit about ADHD, often have a great deal of difficulty having regular sleep and waking patterns. You know, one of the questions is whether there are intrinsic problems with sleep regulatory systems. But, you know, more importantly, we have to remember that sleep is in part a learned behavior. You know, these kids often, because of difficulties kind of regulating themselves and regulating themselves in relation to the environment, will develop sleep problems. Some of these can be related to just the pattern of activities during the daytime, getting back to what Dr. Plant was saying of, you know, we look at a 24-hour pattern. And a lot of times with these kids is, you know, they may be napping a lot during the day, particularly when they're not stimulated or active. And if they're napping during the day, their sleep will become more fragmented at night. They often have difficulty when they wake up at night self-soothing and going back to sleep. So, you know, children including normal children, will frequently wake at night, but a normal child eventually learns how to kind of settle and soothe. And I've certainly seen many kids over the years in clinic, you know, with exactly this problem. They just sort of wake up at night and they sort of become dependent on some interaction with a caregiver. In many cases, aggressive behavioral treatments aimed at both sort of daytime and nighttime behaviors can be helpful. Sometimes medications can be useful, although, you know, we try to avoid use of medications in children. ADHD is a little bit different issue. These children, again, sometimes have trouble settling at night because of some of the restlessness. I think one important thing, though, to keep in mind is to try to distinguish ADHD from another disorder that can happen in kids, which is restless legs that Dr. Plant was mentioning earlier, this uncomfortable sensation or urge to move. And I have certainly seen a number of cases of kids who are brought in who have been diagnosed and treated for ADHD who turn out to have restless legs and oftentimes be quite iron deficient, because iron deficiency in children can contribute to this, and also there's a hereditary component, and sometimes the treatment for the sleep disorder can help. Let's see what else we.
I'd also mention that in children with certain developmental disorders, where sometimes cranial facial structure and anatomy can be altered, they may also be at risk for obstructive sleep apnea. And what's actually very interesting is that children can have basically experienced this full gamut of sleep disorders as adults, but they often look differently clinically. So adults with sleep apnea classically are tired or sleepy during the day, but a tired child, even with developmental disorders, may appear hyperactive. And so that's why it's important to keep some of these other sleep disorders in mind, especially dealing in children with developmental disorders.
Or hyperactive kids, that just to kind of follow up on that, you know, simply having a sleep-deprived child can contribute to what looks like hyperactivity or attentional problems, because that's the classic effect of sleep loss. And in, you know, this day and age, particularly with, you know, parents who may be working late and, you know, overscheduled kids, they may be not getting as much sleep as they need.
Mm-hmm. Does that help you out, Lynn?
Yeah, it does. That's a lot of great ideas. Are there resources that your sleep clinic offers for families of children that are experiencing those issues?
Well, we do have pediatric sleep specialists in our clinic. So we do consultations and evaluations of children with a wide range of other medical or psychiatric issues for their sleep problems, and are happy to see children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Lynn in Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Larry. Very interesting. And I'm wondering if, excluding an organic problem and, you know, and then having dealt with environmental issues, if some people just aren't obsessed about sleep. And knowing that the UW does research with the Buddhists, and being a practitioner of Buddhism myself and having learned mindfulness meditation, I find that very, very useful. And I am a woman of a certain age, you know, with hot flashes and all those things. And I was wondering if there was any research being done on using meditation in place of medication to solve some sleep problems.
Okay.
Great question. I'm glad you asked that. And that sort of gets to the whole issue of how we should be taking care of sleep problems, particularly the more common kinds of insomnia problems, as Larry kind of started out talking about his insomnia related to some ongoing stresses. And certainly stress and anxiety, you know, from a variety of causes, are one of the biggest factors that contribute to sleep problems. And I think that we really underutilize behavioral approaches for sleep. And, you know, all the evidence suggests that various kinds of behavioral treatments are as effective or more effective than medications. I'm glad you brought up the mindfulness meditation, because there are, you know, a number of studies that have shown that mindfulness-based approaches for insomnia can be quite effective. There are a lot of different kinds of behavioral things that can help people with their sleep, and I think the issues for many of them are to sort of decrease the arousal level, decrease our anxiety, as well, of course, teach us good sleep habits. And along those lines, I think it's important for people to do what works best for them. There's no evidence that one treatment is inherently better than another across the board. It's really what works best for you. So if mindfulness works well, you know, there's a lot of data to support that. There are other kinds of behavioral approaches, relaxation therapies. Some people find yoga helpful. And there are specific treatments that have been designed for insomnia that you can usually get access to through a sleep center or a behavioral therapist who's been trained in that, or even through some self-help books. But great point, and something that's always safe to do and can be quite helpful.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. I want to give some others a chance to get on here. Lisa in Appleton, let's turn to you next. Lisa, hello.
Hi. I was in to see my physician a few weeks ago and talking with him about having some sleep issues, and he suggested that I try melatonin. And so I bought some at the drugstore, and it made me hyper, and it made my mind race, and it was a pretty miserable night. And I have some friends who, of course, are always willing to give lots of medical advice and suggested that maybe I didn't take a high enough dose. And I'm going in to see him in another couple weeks anyway, but I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how melatonin is supposed to work and what it does in your body. And
Dr. Plant, you want to take that?
So that's a great question. This is something that comes up a lot in the clinic. So melatonin is a hormone that's produced by the pineal gland at the base of your brain. And basically, you can think of it as a hormone that's secreted in response to when it's supposed to be dark outside. So a lot of times, people will take this supplement over the counter, hoping that will help with their sleep. And for some people, it does. Now, certainly the experience that the caller had feeling hyper...
That's not what you want.
Right. Hopefully she's off of the... she's off of it now. But there's a few important points that I always tell patients about melatonin. First is it's an herbal supplement, basically is how it's regulated. So it's not regulated by the FDA. So what you get in a given pill could vary from store to store or manufacturer to manufacturer. Sometimes the pills don't have any melatonin at all. So it could be an additive or something that you had a side effect to. The other thing, though, is that melatonin... usually higher doses are less helpful, actually, a lot of times. And that's sort of a counterintuitive type of thing. But when I use melatonin clinically, what I tend to suggest is using it in people who have various circadian rhythm disruptions. And if we do use it, we tend to use it in low dose, so usually about a half milligram to 1 milligram. Excuse me. And we actually recommend taking it about 4 to 5 hours before a desired bedtime rather than right at bedtime. So it's a little bit atypical in that sense. But also melatonin can have some, as the caller demonstrated, unusual effects and can actually cause insomnia in certain situations. So it's a valuable tool, but one that has some real caveats associated with it.
All right. Thanks again for calling. Mary in Middleton, or Madison, excuse me. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. I was wondering if he could expand on the aging and when one neuron communicates with the other, is there electrical and a chemical energy going on?
I think the caller's asking about what happens with aging and a little bit more about how that works. So in the brain, on the surface of the brain are nerve cells or neurons, and they connect to each other with processes, sort of long sort of tentacles of the neurons that connect with each other and mostly release chemical signals. And the number of connections between neurons and the density of those connections decreases as we get older, and that is correlated with sort of less deep sleep and more fragmented sleep, and sort of gets into some of the more complicated issues of what we think, you know, is happening during sleep in the brain. But the point is that things that we do to sort of strengthen the connections between our nerve cells during the day may help us sleep a little bit better at night in terms of a behavioral sense. And that's why, in addition to the behavioral treatments that we recommend of, you know, relaxation at night, we also recommend that to sleep well at night, it's important to be awake and active during the day. So, you know, if you sit around like a couch potato all day and don't do a whole lot, your sleep is probably not going to be as good at night as if you're, you know, busy and active and engaged and alert.
Thank you very much for calling. I want to mention, thank Dr. Benka and Dr. Plant for being with us. Dr. Benka is going to be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Perry Hall in the UW Fox Valley's Communication Arts Center on Midway Road in Menasha. And this is the first of several talks on aging. They're free and open to the public. Her talk tonight is titled Good Night, Sleep Right. And so if you're in the Fox Valley area,
I'll be happy to see you there tonight.
Yeah, Communication Arts Center on Midway Road in Menasha. Great place to be tonight at 7 o'clock. And then if you're interested, maybe in the clinic, wisconsinsleep.org, probably the best place to go to learn a little bit more about the clinic itself.
And actually, if you think you might have sleep apnea, we have a little quiz on our website that you can answer some questions. And if you feel
like... And
go from there, yeah.
Thank you both very much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Ruth Benka and Dr. David Plant, who are with the University Center for Sleep Medicine and Sleep Research. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.